Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we continue our series on the U.S. prison system by talking about children behind bars. 2.2 million people are currently in prisons. Almost 80,000 are children. The U.S. juvenile incarceration rate is at its lowest level since 1975, but the U.S. still locks up youth at high rates compared to similarly governed countries. According to the Equal Justice Initiative, thousands of children have been sentenced as adults and have been sent to adult prisons. More than 20 states either require or allow teenagers charged as adults to be put in adult jails while awaiting trial. Studies show that youth held in adult facilities are 36 times more likely to commit suicide and are at the greatest risk of sexual victimization. Nearly 8,000 youth nationwide have been sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. That is 3,000. As many as 17,000 are held in isolation in juvenile jails, most for punishment for a rule violation or because they are on suicide watch. Juvenile justice issues are getting a lot more attention in the media, especially because there's so many conversations being held right now about prison reform. And you may have heard Youth Radio's series Unlocked, which recently aired on NPR's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. It was an incredible series, and you can find links at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Soraya Shockley. She's a reporter with Youth Radio. She was one of the reporters on juvenile probation for Youth Radio's series Unlocked, and Soraya joins me in studio. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming in. We're also joined by Brett Myers. He's senior producer at Youth Radio, and Brett produced and co-reported Youth Radio's series Unlocked. It's also about alternatives to juvenile incarceration, and Brett also joins me in studio. Hi, Brett.
Hi, Rose.
Thank you for coming in. And we're joined by Frankie Guzman. He's an attorney with the National Center for Youth Law in Oakland. Frankie is working to reduce the practice of prosecuting and incarcerating children in California's adult criminal justice system. As a teenager, Frankie struggled with gangs, drugs, and crime. When he was 15, he was arrested and tried for armed robbery and sentenced to 15 years in the California Youth Authority. After serving 6 years of his sentence, he was released on parole, enrolled in Oxnard College, and then transferred to UC Berkeley. He later graduated from UCLA School of Law with a specialization in public interest law and policy. And Frankie is also in studio. Hi, Frankie.
Good morning, Rose.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Frankie, I mean, you have very personal experience with this issue, and you're now a lawyer advocating for youth.
That's right.
And I want to ask you, and I've asked all the guests so far on this series, there's so much talk now about prison reform. Children aren't really in that conversation, but are you hopeful because so many people are talking about these issues?
Yes, absolutely. You know, one thing that we recognize at the National Center for Youth Law, and which is why so many of us work there, is that we understand young people really don't have a voice. You know, they don't have wealth. They don't. They can't vote. They don't have lobbyists really, you know, fighting for their interests at the Capitol. And so really, especially in my experience, what I've seen is, you know, we really are handled at the discretion of adults. And when we are treated poorly and respond poorly, we are often treated as adults and punished in that way. And I've always, you know, part of my big frustration growing up as a young person was seeing the unfairness and with the way that I was treated and not knowing how to respond adequately in a way that was deemed appropriate by the adults who had authority over me. It really caused a lot of problems for me and ultimately resulted in me spending 6 years of my life in juvenile prison to learn, I think, more concretely just how unfair life is, but really contemplating ways to no longer be under the rule of this, you know, just very oppressive. And when I say oppressive, I don't, you know, I mean, you know, for young people, authority. You know, I spent 6 years of my life in the authority, constantly being told by prison guards, the only difference between you and us is that you got caught. And throughout my experience there, you know, I witnessed them bring in the drugs, sexually and physically abuse us. No public defenders, no state senators, no one was allowed in to check and make sure that the place that they sent us to be rehabilitated was actually doing its job and that we were being treated fairly. So really, it was kind of one of these survival of the fittest type of experiences for me, and it just left me really dissatisfied with the way that we treat young people and motivated me to not give up, do not only well for myself and my community, but to help young people behind me.
You were 15 when you were arrested, and you spent 6 years in juvenile prison, sentenced to 15 at the California Youth Authority. The CYA has received so much media attention over the years. What has really changed since the time you spent at the CYA?
I would say the biggest thing that has changed is the numbers. When I was in the California Authority beginning in 1996 and most recently in 2004, you know, there was over 10,000 kids in there. And when I left in 2004, there was about over 6,000. Today, there was less than 600 kids today. And so, you know, I would say the number of kids has dramatically been reduced, but I'm not so convinced that the treatment or the effectiveness of rehabilitation has changed at all, really.
Why have the numbers gone down so much? 10,000 in 1996 to 600 today.
Well, I mean, it's a combination of you know, public awareness as to the egregious you know, kind of misconduct that was happening in the California Authority. You know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a lot of media publicity around the abuses that were happening. You know, even when I was there in 2004, Governor Schwarzenegger was touring the juvenile prisons to basically see firsthand really how bad it was. And so I think counties becoming aware of just how bad the conditions were there stopped sending a lot of their kids there. But there was also juvenile realignment in 2007 that put a limit on the types of offenders that could be sent to the youth authority, no longer permitting counties to just freely send low offending youth there who they were maybe tired of dealing with. They put a price tag on it and required them to pay $250,000 if they wanted to send some of these low offending youth there. And so it really brought down the numbers. And also combined with the fact that the prison law office sued the California Department of Corrections Division of Juvenile Justice over a wide range of abuses using a taxpayer kind of lawsuit, basically claiming that CYA was using tax dollars to basically engage in illegal behavior, which was found to be true. And they entered a settlement agreement to reform all parts of their system. And it really drove up the cost, making it, I think, costly prohibitive for counties to send their kids there. And lastly, in the year 2000, Proposition 21 was passed that allowed prosecutors at their own discretion to prosecute certain youth that were charged with certain offenses as adults, and so effectively diverting them away from the juvenile system and placing them in the adult system. So, you know, between the Farrell lawsuit, Proposition 21, and loss of public and you know, county system support, DJJ really took a hit and went from 10,000 kids in 1996 to less than 600 that we have today.
And that is Frankie Guzman. He's an attorney with the National Center for Youth Law in Oakland. He was 15 when he was arrested and tried for armed robbery, sentenced to 15 years in the California Youth Authority. He spent 6 years in juvenile prison. We're also joined by Saraya Shockley, a reporter with Youth Radio, and Brett Myers, a senior producer with Youth Radio. And they worked on Youth Radio's series Unlocked, which recently aired on NPR's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And Brett, you know, it was amazing. Your pieces were great. But to hear everybody from the guards to the kids who are locked up and hearing about their problems, what is it like today for the media to get access, to find out what the conditions are and to find out what life is like for kids behind bars?
Youth Radio has been covering juvenile justice issues for years, and we've had a range of experiences trying to gain access. For this particular series, access wasn't our main challenge. In the past, we have been locked out, where entire departments have refused to speak with us. There can be little recourse when trying to gain access. But for this series, we kind of had unprecedented access. So I spent a while in juvenile hall in Alameda County and learned a lot.
So talk a little bit about what you learned. One thing that really struck me is in the Alameda County Juvenile Hall, it's a $176 million complex built in 2007 with courtrooms, law offices, and 360 beds for young people. But you found that staff shortages present major, major challenges. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the facility is incredibly clean, you know, and there are lots of really well-intentioned, kind staff there. And then there's a dark side, and it's that staff are overworked. They work an average of 33 hours of overtime per person per week. That's overtime.
Is this in addition to, so it's a 40-hour work week?
Well, it varies. Some okay. people are full-time, some people aren't. But on average, they're all working this huge load of overtime. And keep in mind that some staff don't even live in the Bay Area. They're commuting long distances. So you've got people working doubles, going home for a few hours to sleep and coming back in. And the conditions in the hall are, you know, they can be volatile. And so what you see is an overworked staff. They don't call them guards. They call them juvenile institutional officers. But their primary function is to control and keep a safe environment. So that they are guards. They say that the tool that they use most to maintain order is their voice and talking to young people. But that really requires a level head. And what we heard from young people, from staff, from supervisors, is that staff are kind of pushed to the limit. And so what we see is that the conditions are deteriorating. The good news is that there are fewer young people in Alameda County Juvenile Hall than there have been at almost any point since it opened. So 5 years ago, as compared to 5 years ago, there are a third fewer kids in the hall. So that's the good news. The bad news is that there are more fights, there are more pepper spray incidents, so guards are using pepper spray on young people more often, and takedowns, where guards take down a young person, will restrain them physically, and then put them in handcuffs. That number's up almost 200%. And that's distributed. All those bad indicators are distributed across a much smaller pool of young people. So the conditions are really, really, you know, going downhill.
In your piece about the Alameda County Juvenile Hall, Supervisor Ray Colon said that the kids don't always get the services they should get because we're running short. They spend more time in their room, which is unfortunate, but it's the reality of not having the staff to complete the duties we need to do.
Yeah. So one of the things he's referring to is a policy called split rec. We called other counties around the state, and we had a hard time finding any county who would admit to running split recs. And so what that policy means, in effect, is that a unit, there are many units within Juvenile Hall. A lot of them are 30-bed units. They're two stories high. There are 15 cells on each level. And in the evenings, there's recreation time. There's large muscle exercise. There's dinner. And so normally what happens is the young people all come out and they enjoy recreation. They enjoy their exercise. They do that as a unit, all 30 people. When the state has a mandate, it's a ratio of one guard for every 10 young people. And when they don't have the staff to meet that minimum ratio, so if they have two guards in a 30-bed unit, what they do is they bring out half the unit. So they'll bring out 15 kids. The other 15 remain in their cells. And so what you have is young people spending more time in their cells than they normally do. And then they also get less recreation, less exercise, less time to eat. And what we hear from everybody, from guards, from young people, is it creates a bit of a vicious cycle. Young people are more stressed, they're more angry. Guards are more stressed, they're more angry. So there are more fights, more use of pepper spray, and it becomes this cycle. And the staffing problem has gone on for a long time.
And what are the solutions to this, Saraya? I mean, what did you hear from staff about the changes that they would like to see? Because it seems like this results in even more problems that they then have to deal with.
Sure. The only... Can we... You not hear me?
Go ahead.
The only issues that... The real issues that we found were that with understaffing, a lot of the kids would be far more agitated and these fights would increase. And so the real call is for proper staffing, you know, to make sure that that these facilities are properly staffed so that if juveniles are put into juvenile halls, that they are properly cared for as mandated by the state and as mandated by, I think, what most people think is common sense. That's really what we found. I think the access Brett got to a lot of these people inside a juvenile hall shows that they really do have good intentions, but without the proper staffing and without the proper tools to do their jobs, they can't do what they would like to do.
And I think it's worth noting that juvenile hall in Alameda County, it's run by the Alameda County Probation Department, You know, something that throughout the state, almost all probation departments are they're adult and youth, all managed by the same department. The facility, they're about on average last year there were about 150 kids on any given day, and it costs $48 million a year.
Wow.
To maintain the facility.
$48 million. I was just checking out the. There's this amazing project called Juveniles in Justice. It's a photo exhibit. And according to the American Correctional Association, the average cost to incarcerate a young person for a 9 to 12 month period is between $66,000 and $88,000. In California, the cost is almost $225,000. We talked about how that money is spent and who's benefiting from the prison system, $80 billion a year. $224,000 to incarcerate a juvenile a year in California, how is that money spent?
Probably on overtime.
Really, it's that big of a chunk.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I what I often hear, you know, people in juvenile corrections say is, you know, all these requirements that they treat kids, you know, with dignity and respect and with all these, you know, different various types of treatment is what drives up the cost. You know, and certainly that was the case in the California Youth Authority where, you know, we basically were just running a juvenile prison. It was just scaled down to and painted light blue to make it a little more appropriate for juveniles. But essentially it was just a prison yard. And now with, you know, thanks to, you know, the federal lawsuit, they are required to have, you know, kind of minimum standards for treatment for safety and security and all that. And so it has driven up the cost in at the state level. I'm not sure why it would cost that much at the county level unless they have a really intensive treatment ranch program or something where they have very small ratios. You know, Santa Clara County has the James Ranch where their staffing ratio is six kids for every one staff member, and it really does focus on cognitive and behavioral health and treatment. And so I would understand why such an investment there should be made, but I'm not sure why a juvenile hall would cost that much unless you're just building very expensive state-of-the-art facilities that really just resemble prisons more than anything. Mm-hmm.
Frankie Guzman is an attorney with the National Center for Youth Law. He spent 6 years in the California Youth Authority. He was 15 when he was arrested and tried for armed robbery, and he was actually sentenced to 15 years. We're also joined by Saraya Shockley, reporter with Youth Radio. She was one of the reporters on juvenile probation for Youth Radio's series Unlocked, recently aired on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And Brett Myers is a senior producer at Youth Radio who produced and co-reported the series. Today we are continuing our week-long series on the U.S. prison system by talking about children behind bars. 80,000 young people are currently behind bars in the United States. And at that number, the U.S. juvenile incarceration rate is at its lowest since 1975. 17,000 young people are held in isolation, most for punishment for a rule violation or because they're on suicide watch. We'll talk about that in a few minutes because isolation and solitary confinement is getting a lot more attention in the national media. So what questions do you have about youth in prison? This is one topic that doesn't get as much attention in the conversations that we're hearing about prison reform. If you work on these issues, if you spent time behind bars when you were young or you know someone who has, what was that experience like? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Saraya, your reporting examined probation practices and how they often end up creating longer sentences. Talk about that. What did you find?
Yeah, so probation is seen as one of the major alternatives to locking kids up. And in our reporting, what we found was that even though probation is meant to be an alternative, a lot of the times it leads to kids being locked up anyway. So one of the techniques used on probation is to give kids a GPS monitor, which monitors their movements, and courts order kids to be placed within certain locations so they can only be at school or home or their job. And if they're not, then they would violate their conditions of the court, and that could lead to them being locked up. So one young man we talked to, he committed a relatively small crime. So he stole about $85 worth of sneakers. And he was charged with a misdemeanor, which landed him on probation. However, while on probation on a GPS monitor, because he would sometimes not follow his ordered locations, he would be locked up. And over the 18 months he was on probation, he would end up being in juvenile hall over 10 times, even though the whole point of probation was to not have him be incarcerated.
For sneakers?
For sneakers, yes. Yes.
How common is that?
We've seen a couple cases within our reporting of that. I can't speak exactly to the numbers, but, you know, probation, a lot of the times probation is for kids that have committed relatively small crimes, yes.
So 80,000 people, it was really hard to find a breakdown in numbers and just in terms of what these kids are in for. Basically, what I read is most of them are for nonviolent offenses. Do we have that data? Do we know why these kids are in prisons and jails?
Well, I can tell you from one example within the reporting that we did that in Yolo County, California, 56% of the youth that are in their juvenile hall are just there for probation violations. So that speaks to this sort of probation not really being an alternative to jail and how to improve the probation system to better serve youth and the taxpayers, because we know that incarceration is the most expensive version of youth punishment. And so if you want to better serve taxpayers or the youth in general, that's what our reporting was really trying to start a conversation on, was just how to better a probation system that's meant to be an alternative.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty interesting to peel back the curtain and talk about some of these tools that are used. So the GPS ankle monitor, it's grown in popularity. 48 out of 50 states allow the use of GPS ankle monitoring on young people. At one point in Alameda County, they ran out of the devices because they were used so often. Public defenders and DAs and judges kind of agree that, yeah, it's better than locking a kid up. And it's pretty rare that those folks all agree on the same thing. But where you get to the rub is, well, who should be assigned ankle monitoring? And so the real issue is with is something called net widening, where it's a tool that that's often seen as kind of a benign tool, and so it gets applied universally, kind of reflexively is the argument that a lot of public defenders will make, that that like people know that incarcerating a young person has negative effects. But GPS ankle monitoring isn't thought of as necessarily a bad thing. And so it kind of gets applied to a lot of kids who wouldn't be sent to the hall otherwise. And what you have to understand is there's a big thing attached to your ankle. There's a stigma that's attached to that big thing attached to your ankle. So you go to school and other kids can see it under your pants. At 7 o'clock every night, you have to charge it. And it's a 2-hour charge. And you have...
Hold that thought. Let's talk more about this GPS monitoring system and how this works. Today, we are continuing our series on U.S. prisons by talking about children behind bars. 80,000 children are currently behind bars in the U.S. We'll be back after this.
This is your call on local public radio, KALW. If you have a perspective you haven't yet heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, you can join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-TALK. If you prefer to write an email rather than get to the phone, The email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say. Following that at noon today, it's Ira Glass and This American Life.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our series on prisons by talking about reform and rehabilitation. In 2011, California Governor Brown signed realignment bills to reduce the state's prison population. As of last week, it was down by 27,000. So what resources are available inside and outside of prison to help people with the transition process, and what prevents released inmates from going back to prison? That is tomorrow. And then on Friday, it's our media roundtable, and we will be talking to journalists about coverage of these issues. Today, we are talking about youth behind bars. There are 80,000 children in jails and prison. And if you take a look at how many are in isolation, 17,000 are currently held in isolation. And we'll talk about solitary confinement in just a bit. Today, I'm joined by Saraya Shockley, reporter with Youth Radio. She was a reporter on the Juvenile Probation for Youth Radio series Unlocked. It aired on All Things Considered and Morning Edition. Find links at yourcallradio.org. Brett Myers is senior producer at Youth Radio. He produced and co-reported the series Unlocked. And Frankie Guzman is an attorney with the National Center for Youth Law in Oakland. And Frankie spent 6 years at the California Youth Authority. When he was 15, he was arrested and tried for armed robbery and sentenced to 15 years at the CYA. Frankie, how are you able to bring the sentence down from 15 to 6?
Well, fortunately for me, I was found fit to remain in juvenile court. I actually committed my crime with my friend, co-defendant, who was 16 years old, who had one prior for possession of a stolen check. Because of that one prior adjudication, he was deemed a sophisticated criminal, transferred to the adult system by the decision of a judge. While in the adult system, he was sentenced to 6 years, or 7 years rather, for his part in this robbery. I, on the other hand, it was my first offense. I committed this crime, and the judge, I think mainly to make an example out of me, gave me the maximum available time, which was 15 years. However, because I was in the juvenile court system, the juvenile court jurisdiction at the time only went so far as to my 25th birthday, so in effect, I had a 10-year sentence. Once in the CYA, you can earn good time credits or even be eligible for parole after a certain minimum time. For me, that was a 2-year minimum, but I ended up serving 3 years. And so really, if I had gotten in more fights or misbehaved, I could have received time adds that would have allowed them to keep me the entire 10 years. But fortunately for me, that wasn't the case. You know, I mostly tried to behave as best I could, given, you know, kind of the circumstances. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of just chaos. And, you know, I did fight a significant amount. However, you know, I also had an ability to explain why it was my behavior was not model behavior to the parole board. And ultimately, they decided not to give me as much of a time as they would to other of my, you know, my peers there. I remember, you know, at that time, it was customary to give a kid 6 months time add for every fight. If you had 3 fights, that's a year and a half time add. And so many kids would max out, what we called basically max out was, you know, using up all your time in that system. And so, you know, kids would arrive at, you know, 16 years of age with a 2-year minimum and stay until they're 25 simply because they couldn't avoid the time adds. And, you know, after a few years, you know, the state legislature put a limit on the ability of the juvenile parole board to give that much time for just arbitrary and biased reasons. You know, but that was basically my story. I went there with the 2-year minimum, served 3. And when I got out, I just want to explain, I only lasted out 3 months the first time I was out because I just really couldn't deal with life on life's terms on the outside and returned for a year. When I got out, I was nearly 20 years old, and I was only out 2 months this time for the same reasons. I had a great deal of anxiety, PTSD, stress, anger, and really no, idea of what it meant to be a responsible adult. You know, one thing I always say, my mom tormented me with saying, I need you to grow up and be a man. But I had no idea what a man was. And even to today, I kind of doubt that I know what that is, you know, but it was a lot of pressure for a young person who really had none of the tools. And as a result, I went back for an additional 3 years in parole violations.
Can you talk a little bit about what it is like behind bars? Because this is another thing that we don't spend much time on. And you read these reports, right? Like the Annie E. Casey Foundation finds that in juvenile detention facilities, there's excessive use of force, physical abuse, sexual abuse, isolation, youth-on-youth violence, violence against staff. You read these things, but unless you know someone, it's hard to really get a sense of what actually does go on behind closed doors.
Yeah, you know, I if I could define my experience in one word, it would be fear. If I had a second word, I would say sadness. When I went to juvenile hall, it was a little different. I think in juvenile hall, I was still somewhat in my community. I had my parents visiting me, or my mother at least, regularly. And so I did have to fight a lot in juvenile hall because of gang-related issues. Once I went to CYA, everything changed. And I will say, to a great degree, the adults there stopped being adults. They became prison guards. And everything was a barking and a threat. And if you didn't behave, you could count on being physically abused by these guards in all sorts of ways. I remember when I was there at Nellis Youth Correctional Facility in Whittier, you know, a common practice was when you had a kid misbehave, you would handcuff this kid and tilt him forward so he's off balance, and you let him go face first with his hands handcuffed behind his back. And what often would result was a broken nose, a broken cheekbone, broken teeth. And that was done in full view of the entire 80 kid dorm. You know, we were kept in dorms with 80 kids, and it was really to make an example that this is what happens to kids who misbehave. You know, when we did have inspectors or other people who were there to investigate, you know, instances of abuses, we were threatened ahead of time. If anybody talked to them, we were going to be in lockup for a year or more. Because at that time, there were lockup units where kids would spend 1 to 2 years in lockup. And those kids, invariably, when they returned to the mainline, went back to lockup in a matter of days, if not hours, because of, I think, just deterioration. They came out crazy. And so, you know, for me, I grew up seeing that. I really was, you know, just upset daily by what I observed. But I always felt like that cannot be me. And survival was foremost in my mind.
You went back to prison twice. So what was it that got you out the last time and prevented you from going back again?
Well, the very last time that I went, I was 23 years old. And, you know, to make a long story very short is, you know, I was dealing with depression and lack of employment opportunities. And so that ultimately resulted in me being found in possession of a controlled substance, which was crack cocaine. And I was essentially given a 16-year sentence, I mean a six-month sentence in county jail with an additional 1 year in CYA on the parole violation to be ran concurrently, or consecutively, rather. And so I spent a year and a half that time as a man. You know, I was 23 and 24 years old, and I went back to the California Authority in Chino, which was a YTS. And being there, you know, the program, standard program, was 23 hours in your cell, 1 hour out. Everybody got that program. There was no deviation from that program. If anything, it can be reduced if you misbehaved. And so being there, I would say that was the most violent institution that I had been in my 6 years in the Youth Authority. And I think it was primarily attributable to the fact that we were kept in isolation, single person cells for 23 hours a day. And I did not, I dreaded the moment when they racked our cell doors open, because every single time there was war-on-war violence, and it was usually race-based. Black and brown kids were just not getting along in that facility. And so having to live there for a year really just kind of, I hit rock bottom. You know, I don't carry these racist beliefs. You know, I didn't feel the anger and the rage towards these other kids. If anything, my anger was at the system. And so I did as much as I could to stay off the mainline. I had three different jobs. I was a grievance clerk. I took a different college class every night. When I got out at age 24, I committed to myself like never before that I would not return. And I just spent all of my time at community college, which became my safe haven in my community. There are no community centers. There are no youth groups. All there was in my mind was that place that I've never seen anybody go to or graduate from, but that's my last hope. And I went there, and I made good with it.
And then you went to UCLA School of Law, and you graduated with a specialization in public interest law and policy, and now you're an attorney with the National Center for Youth Law.
Yes.
Do you know what happened to your friend?
Yeah, he, you know, he got out after serving his time and returned. I believe the first time he was rearrested for being in possession of rims that had been stolen. So he had purchased rims off the black market and went to prison for that. Got out, and I believe he was rearrested again for possession of a firearm, for which there's a mandatory minimum 5-year sentence. And so he never really, I would say, recovered from his experience, because when you do get an adult felony for armed robbery, it does affect your ability to go to college, to get certain types of employment, housing, and education. And so I don't want to say blessed. To me, like, it was a blessing that I went to jail, but I definitely was fortunate to have been kept in the juvenile system, where I was able to basically live a new life upon, you know, kind of achieving adulthood.
And that is Frankie Guzman, attorney with the National Center for Youth Law, sharing his experience about what it was like to spend 6 years behind bars in California. We're also joined by Saraya Shockley, reporter with Youth Radio, one of the reporters on the Juvenile Probation for Youth Radio's series Unlocked. Brett Myers, a senior producer at Youth Radio. He produced and co-reported the series Unlocked. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Today we are continuing our series on the prison system by talking about young people behind bars. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You talked about solitary confinement, and I'd like to talk about this because the story of Khalif Browder is just really shocking. So on May 15th, 2010, he was 16. He was arrested for allegedly stealing a backpack in the Bronx. His mom could not afford the $3,000 in bail, so he was sent to Rikers in New York, one of the most violent prisons in the United States. He spent 3 years at Rikers, more than 800 days in solitary. He attempted suicide 6 times. His court date was postponed 31 times, never given a trial, never convicted of a crime. He was released. All charges were dropped in June 2013. On June 6, 2015, 2 years to the date he got out, he hanged himself with an air conditioner cord at his home in the Bronx, and he was just 22. And that week, he was supposed to go back to court to face charges of disorderly conduct. This story has gotten so much attention. The New Yorker wrote a long profile of Khalif before he committed suicide. And then so many in the media found out about this thanks to The New Yorker and reported on it. And so now we are learning so much more about solitary confinement. And Saraya, we were talking about this before the show. What are your thoughts about just what happens when you actually expose issues like this? Because since this happened, Senators Cory Booker and Rand Paul, Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey, Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, have introduced a bill that would prohibit almost all solitary confinement of juveniles in the federal system. We also have a bill in California.
As a youth myself, the most important thing the most valuable thing I've found working with Youth Radio is being able to expose youth issues. And so the story that you're talking about is very impactful. We, during our reporting, we also found in people that we interviewed in juvenile hall that there was a lot of anger and other mental issues that they suffered. I also talked to a young man on probation who went in and out of juvenile hall, and he suffered from depression and anxiety about going back. And so as a youth who has a job of some sort of voice for other youths, it's been very important just to be able to speak up for my peers who don't have a voice. And that's what our reporting did. And that's what Mr. Guzman has been doing his entire career, is being able to just speak for those that don't have a voice, for Khalif, who probably felt lonely and didn't have someone to back him up. And that's all our job is to shine light and hope a conversation is started by those in power, because youth are not the ones that are in power.
Well, and with the case of Khalif, I mean, he just talked about how he just lost his childhood. He said he felt like he was 45 when he got out. And then his mom said that he would, on a regular basis, just walk the line of the driveway, the four corners, over and over and over again. And he wrote a term paper, actually, on solitary confinement once he got out. He was actually doing pretty well in school. But, Brett, what are your thoughts on just the power of really telling these stories?
Well, I think we've learned that regardless of what a young person's sentence is, that the impacts extend, you know, so far beyond.
Right.
And we've seen, you know, we've seen huge changes in this country over the last 15 plus years. So from 99 to 2013, we're locking up 50% fewer kids than we used to. California underwent realignment, and now young people are spending more time, if they are incarcerated, in county lockups like the juvenile hall we covered. And obviously there are problems there. But I think there's also hope. You know, we're at a moment of great change when it comes to juvenile justice policy. And so I think a lot of the discussion is about, well, how juvenile justice by definition, and this is different than adult criminal justice, by definition, juvenile justice is about reform. And so really the discussion needs to be, well, how do we really make good on that promise?
Right.
So we covered, and Soraya covered, Wayne County in Michigan, and that's where Detroit is. And in 2000, they rewrote the way juvenile justice works in that county.
Yeah, why don't you tell us about what you found there?
Sure. So right now, Wayne County is in really an experiment, a 15-year experiment, where they have completely taken over probation from the state. And they are now making it so that they contract local nonprofits, so an infrastructure that's already there, that's there to help youth. And they've changed their system from a law and order approach, in which you just trail kids with GPS, make them pee into a cup, make sure they're not taking drugs, and if they are, send them back to juvie. Instead of doing that, they've changed it into a more therapeutic approach, where there are still court orders, they still have to follow rules, but instead, they're backed up by a system that is meant to help them. And that was really the story that we were hearing from Wayne County. We talked to a young woman named Debbie, who is just about to graduate from high school, actually. And she was talking about how there's actual support for her and her family, which is another important step, is that for young people, a lot of the times, it's not an isolated event, right? These are people that belong to families that usually still live in their families' homes. So this is a ripple effect sort of thing if they're sent to juvie or put onto probation. And Wayne County has done a really good job of supporting both the youth and their families, making sure they're connected to services, and making sure that the focus is rehabilitation, not retribution for their crimes, but really making sure that these kids get the support they need.
And their results are borne out in numbers. So before the reforms, recidivism for young people hovered around 60%, super high rate of young people going back to incarceration after they were incarcerated already. Flash forward 15 years, and you see that recidivism in Wayne County is down to 16%, and there's a huge cost savings associated with that. And it's also, like, there's a huge opportunity cost when young people go to jail over and over again, a cost to the whole country. And so Wayne County's model is something that New York is studying, that counties, New York City is studying. Counties all over the country are looking at Wayne County's model is a potential model to adopt.
Frankie, what are your thoughts on models like that?
Well, I think, you know, education and therapy, rehabilitation is important. But I just wanted to just kind of identify one issue that I have with this idea about rehabilitation. I think, you know, we're basically applying adult corrections or adult, you know, criminal, you know, kind of criminal ideas to children. When you talk about rehabilitation by definition means restoring somebody back to their original condition. For some of these kids, that's 3 years old. So how do you rehabilitate that which has not learned to live functionally in the first instance? And I think what we needed to be doing within the juvenile system is understanding where our kids are really at and educate them to become good kids first and then, you know, good adults. When I was on parole, I think that was one of the biggest challenges that I had was I had a parole officer who would come and meet with me once a month for 15 to 30 minutes each time with a cup to pee in and a threat. that if I messed up, I'm going back. But I really had, I mean, I didn't get ever a job referral, a referral to, you know, mental health treatment, you know, no idea about how to become educated. And so really all of this I discovered through growing up, trial and error, you know, a lot more error than than I would have liked. But it was very difficult. And fortunately for me, I was able to grow up largely because I had a mother who never gave up on me. I had a community.
I was going to ask about that. Did you have a supportive family and community? Because reading about some of these kids in this amazing photo essay, and we'll put this at yourcallradio.org, their parents don't visit them in prison. They have no family members that are supporting them.
Yes. Yeah. And I would say I noticed that the kids in CYA that did not have families visiting them did the worst. And those kids that had strong family connections often did the best. And right. I will say, you know, I definitely was affected by, you know, growing up in a broken home. My brother, when I was age 5 years old, was arrested for murder, tried as an adult, and sentenced to 17 years to life. Today, 30 years later, he's still in prison for that crime he committed as a 16-year-old kid. It affected me deeply, so that when I grew up, I really didn't know which way was up and which way was down. And going to jail, then I really internalized this idea that we are discardable. And so getting out, to have people say, you know, be a man, do good, I just really had no idea what that was or why it was important to do these things. And so being, I think, living at rock bottom for long enough, I just, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about how not to lose, how not to be this powerless ever again. And I always understood education was that, even if it was just in words. People always told me, you're smart, you should go to school, but I have no idea how that happens. There are no real available mentors, so to speak, in these communities, especially like the one that I come from. But there's an abundance of law enforcement. You know, we talk about, you know, resources, you know, not being available in these communities. My mom, as I always say, she tried to do the right thing. She put me in Little League Baseball to have a positive activity for me. But unfortunately for me, my Little League Baseball league was not really invested in. We had no uniforms, and we only had two teams. So I played the same team every game. And to me, it was just demoralizing. And people love to laugh at when I say this in crowds, but I just think it kind of speaks to how sad and ridiculous this is, that kids don't really have what we would consider necessary for positive youth development.
Where did you grow up?
Oxnard, California, okay. In a community called La Colonia. It's a barrio.
So, yeah, and just to respond, it's one of the things that we found really striking about our reporting in Wayne County was that one of the reasons that recidivism is so low now in Wayne County, holding at about 16%, is because kids are given support, right? And it's not, so rehabilitation might be the wrong word, but these kids are actually given support and adults to seek help from, and their families are given that same support so that they can find a different path, at least given the opportunity to find a different path. And I think that's what is important, is if you these systems that we've looked at and investigated, is just how do you better serve youth so that they don't continue down that path? Because isn't that the whole point of probation and the juvenile system in general?
Do you see things on that front changing in California?
No, I think what we see is a lot of the same old when it comes to the approach of probation officers, which is really judges give kids a list of demands, their court orders, anywhere from 20 to 25. They can be very subjective. Be of good citizenship. Obey your parents. Go to school on time. Get good grades. And it's a system of checks. And for kids who are already struggling, we're setting a lot of kids up to fail. And then when they do fail, it's a backdoor into jail. So this alternative to probation, or this alternative to incarceration, which is what probation is meant to be, really for a lot of kids ends up being a backdoor into incarceration.
And that's why we did the sort of juxtaposition between these two stories of juvenile or of probation in California and then also probation in Wayne County, Michigan, was just to give you an idea of the two different systems that are happening in the U.S.
Where was the idea in Michigan? Where did that come from? How did that come to be?
There's So they also went through a realignment phase in the early, in the late 90s. And so that moved a lot of kids out of the juvenile system, some into adult systems. But after that, there was just a call for change because of the high recidivism rates. And I'm not exactly sure where the idea came from, but it was just one of those common sense moves to use infrastructure that was already there, community organizations, to make sure that probation was more therapeutic. And that's what Wayne County decided was their approach. And it was an experiment. They weren't sure if it was going to work. It was a long-term investment and continues to be a community investment in the idea of therapeutic probation. So that's what Wayne County decided to do in 2000.
And we have just about a minute left. Frankie, what changes would you like to see now that this conversation about prison reform is happening, regardless of where you stand politically?
Well, I mean, what changes? I mean, I would have a...
I mean, let's say two at the top of your list.
I would say moving to a public health approach to dealing with delinquency. I think for too long we have deferred to law enforcement and these people who would attempt to coerce through fear and aggression and sometimes violence in order to produce a certain type of behavior, where what we're talking about is young people who need help, who are often suffering from abuse, abandonment, neglect, and these overwhelming negative emotions that often kind of contribute to their behavior. What we need to do is start helping our kids and our families and our communities to heal, and not just give them more violence and in effect actually just marginalizing them and having whole parts of our community just divesting from the mainstream, the education, college. Like, it's not happening for a lot of us. And so when we talk about, are these changes happening in California? To a small degree, they are. Diversion programs are happening, and we have seen our juvenile halls and prisons reduced in number. But predominantly, it's helping white kids and affluent kids. Our black and brown kids, kids with mental health issues still remain in these systems. And so what I would like to see is us moving away from deferring to prosecutors, cops, probation officers who really know nothing about teenagers and focusing more on treatment.
And we got a lot of emails from listeners saying thank you for sharing your story. Frankie Guzman is an attorney with the National Center for Youth Law in Oakland. He spent 6 years behind bars in California. He was 15 when he was arrested and tried for armed robbery. We're also joined by Saraya Shockley, a reporter with Youth Radio, Brett Myers, senior producer with Youth Radio, and you can find links to their series Unlocked at yourcallradio.org. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What does effective prison reform and rehabilitation look like? On the next Your Call, we continue our week-long series on the U.S. prison system by talking about rehabilitation. In 2011, Governor Brown signed California's realignment bills to reduce the state's prison population. As of last week, it was down by 27,000. So what resources are available inside and outside of prison to help people with the transition process? And what prevents released inmates from going back to prison? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.